On August 28th, 2012, author Don Fry came to Writer House for the event Writing Your Way Without Agony. Interview by Writer House board member Walker Thornton.
So let me introduce Don to you. I'm going to read this so I get it just right. Don has a long and varied history with writing and teaching. He's taught over 10,000 writers worldwide to write better and faster with less agony, and that's his phrase.
Less agony.
Less agony. He's already coached me at dinner, so he likes this thing. Don first taught medieval literature here at UVA in the late 60s, maybe the 70s, I want to make him Beowulf, actually. So he taught English here, and then he also went on to teach at Stony Brook University in upstate New York. New York, okay. And then from there, he headed the Writing and Ethics Facility at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. And at that point, and I think he'll probably tell us about that, he was editing the Institute's series called Best Newspaper Writing. And his work really focused on working with newspaper. About 1994, he totally switched careers, and he became an independent writing coach. And so since that time, Don has been working with newspapers, magazines, radios, TV stations, and nonprofits, helping people learn to be better writers. He's published hundreds of articles, and this book is his 18th book. And I discovered last night that he's just published a fiction book as well called, hold on, How to Shoot Your Father, which is available on Amazon. So Don lives here in Charlottesville with his wife, Joan, who is a writer, occasionally does radio columns. And one of the things that Don said, and I'll leave this as he begins to go into this, he voiced his sort of goal or his mission as one of helping writers create their own writing process by strengthening their strengths and changing or avoiding their weaknesses. So I'll turn it over to you, and if you'd like to read to us.
Good. Thank you very much. I thought I would read a little bit to you from the book, and then we'll go back to Walker and talk a while. Okay? And so you'll hear I'm going to stand up for this. This is a section from the book called Planners and Plungers. Sometimes you recognize this as outliners and non-outliners. This is a very thin way to discuss this problem. I'll try to go into depth on this one. So this is about two pages of the book. Human beings divide into two types, planners and plungers. Planners figure out what to do, and then they do it. Plungers figure things out by doing them. Planners plan and execute their plan. Plungers organize by acting. Imagine a buffet lunch. Planners walk around the whole table looking at all the food, decide what they want, and then pick up a plate. Plungers grab a plate and select what looks good to them. Planners plan their meal. Plungers dive into the food, making decisions as they go along. Let's talk about navigation. My wife Joan and I are going to drive somewhere, and I have the wheel. I'm a planner. So I look at a map and plan my route. If Joan, a plunger, has the wheel, she'll start in the general direction and correct as she goes along. We both get to the same place at the same time. Well, how will we drive to the same place the second time? I again have the wheel, so I look at the map again and go the way I went the first time. Planners are rigid. How will my wife navigate the second time? She starts in a different direction and corrects until she arrives. Plungers like variety. Again, we both get there at the same time, but we thought it out in different ways. We're talking about an entirely different way of thinking about the world. The distinction applies to writers as well. Planners write plans and follow them. Plungers just start typing and organize toward the end. Planners plan and execute their plan. Plungers plunge in and write by discovery. As a planner, I always write a plan before I type, but not the classical multi-layered outline you hated in school. Roman 1, big A, little 1, little A, all that sort of thing. Awful. An outline is a great way to analyze something that is already written, but not to plan something, unless you're a total control freak. I just like outlines so much that I call them plans. I write mostly columns, and I write my columns with a beginning, a few sections, and an ending. My simple plan consists of a few words, just labels for the parts and their order. then I follow the plan, but not necessarily in order. I write the beginning last, always. How would a plunger do that? They would type a lot of units, sentences, paragraphs, sections, just stuff. Then they arrange the bits and pieces into sections that make sense and write transitions between the parts. Some write the beginning first, some later, some last. Plungers figured out what they want to say by typing it. Then they rearrange it to make sense to themselves and to their readers. Both planners and plungers, if they use methods suitable to them, can write at the same speed and the same quality. And you can't tell planners from plungers by reading what they write. You have to ask them about their writing process and how they think. Here's the problem for plungers. The world of writing is ruled by planners. Most writing teachers are planners. Most writing gurus are planners. All nuns are planners. All editors are planners. I'm a planner. So how do plungers get along in a world dominated by planners? Simple. They pretend to be planners. Okay, about a third of you figured out you're plungers. Let's go back to your youth. Suppose you're a plunger in the sixth grade English class in early September. The assignment, write 500 words on my summer vacation and turn it in with the outline used to write it. Plungers, do you know how you did that? You wrote and finished 500 words and then outlined them. What's called a back outline. And the nun thought you were a planner like her and gave you an A, and that's why you're in this room today. If you've decided you're a plunger, come out of the closet. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with you. About a third of the writers in the world I know are plungers and they're proud of it. What's the dark side of planners and plungers? Planners are rigid. They'll follow a bad plan even when they realize it isn't working. I usually make a mess of planning part three of my columns, and I type it anyway. Plungers write a lot to figure out what they want to say, so they write long and cut back, which makes them inherently slow. Both are helped by a good debriefing, talking to someone just before they type about what they intend to say and how. If the debriefer doesn't understand the plan, neither does the planner. So the plan gets rethought before it's typed. The secret of writing fast with confidence is to know what you want to say. With a plunger, the debriefer listens for things that have nothing to do with the piece, and they don't get typed at all. Either way saves time and effort. Plungers can save time by drafting without revising at all. Otherwise, they cut things they've already revised. So for a plunger, the fastest sequence would be type, cut, rearrange, revise. So that way you don't cut anything that you've revised. Very few writers are pure planners or plungers. For instance, I plan nonfiction and plunge fiction. I outline columns, but I start novels without a plot. Some people plan short and plunge long, and vice versa. Some plunge when they're afraid and plan when they're not. Some plan the top and plunge the rest. Whatever works for you, but make sure you plan or plunge based on your strengths, not habit or ignorance. In general, people who plan their lives write better using planner methods. People who plunge through life feel more comfortable plunging their writing. The trick is to know lots of ways to do things and choose the combination that works best for you. So, are you a planner or a plunger?
Thank you. So one of my questions is going to be, why are all nuns planners? But you've already answered that, so we'll move on. So you've had this long, varied, fascinating career, going from Beowulf, which I would, from my non-literary place, would sort of question the, you know, the fascination piece of Beowulf. But I get.
I wish you hadn't
is.
Said that, because when you say that he started with Beowulf, the whole audience says, "Oh God,
Beowulf." Oh, but wait, oh, but
long
wait.
Night.
Oh no, no, no. But you have all these wonderful anecdotes in the book. I mean, just fascinating stories that I think that you've picked up along that way. So. Share with us the process of what led you to write this particular book.
I have been coaching writers since 1980, and I've been teaching writing since 1980, and I've also been teaching editors primarily how to coach. Mostly I worked with newspapers for a long time. And about 2 years ago, I suddenly realized that although I'd taught writing, I had never written about how to write better. I'd written about how to help your writers write better. I'd written about coaching. So I decided I should write a book about how to write better. And the thesis of the book, of course, is You design your own writing process that works for you, not one that works for your teachers. Most writers learn how to write one way, and they spend the rest of their lives writing like that. And the way you write may not be suitable for you at all, not one bit. I coached a television producer who would take 3 weeks to write 500 words. And I said, why does it take you so long? And he said, well, I write a sentence, and then I go on the internet, and I check every word in it to make sure it's correct. And I said, why do you do that? And he said, how else would you do it? You see, that was the only way he knew to write, and so he essentially crippled himself by not knowing any other way to write. So the principle of the book is, you learn a lot of ways to do the different steps of the writing process, and you write your own writing process, essentially.
You know, I'm kind of fascinated by the notion, write to what your strengths are. Mm-hmm. So know what's a strong place for you and write that way.
Right.
Because I think we don't always do that. And so it seems to me in the process, and you sort of sum this up towards the end of the book, which is you have to understand what your strengths are mm-hmm. in order to look at this. And so it requires a little evaluation, self-evaluation,
yes.
to get
well,
to that.
If you're going to rewrite, if you're going to come up with a new writing process, you ask yourself two questions. What are my strengths and what are my weaknesses? And then you design a writing process that uses your strengths and either changes or avoids your weaknesses. To give an example, my strength is organization. You've already seen me talk and you can tell that. I'm just good at organizing stuff. And so I do everything to maximize my early organizing skills. My weakness is that I type badly. I type 4 words a minute. 4 words a minute. This does not mean that words fall out of my fingers at 4 words a minute. It means by the time I correct it all, it comes out to about 4 words a minute. And so, I've designed a writing process that compensates for my bad typing. I cannot change my bad typing. I keep trying, it just doesn't work. And so I do other things that make me extremely fast to compensate for this bad typing.
Something that fascinates me in this book, because I'm a freelance writer, a very short term. I've been doing this for a long, long time. I'm also a blogger.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many stories out there of bloggers who were discovered through their blog and got to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
You have a process that's similar but not at all really the same.
Mm-hmm.
Explain how you got to this book and where your material came. And if you would, complex questions, I'm sorry you're not
okay.
supposed to do that with an interview.
talk about right, one question at a time.
I never do that.
It's okay.
So, and then when you've done that, talk about how the process that you had to use to get it to this.
Okay. As I said, I decided that I would write this book about how to write, something that I'd never written about. I talked about it, but I hadn't written about it. And my son, who is a techie, said, you should write that as a blog. And I'm the last person in the world to write a blog. I have no social skills whatever. I have no social network skills whatever. But he talked me into it, and I already had two voices. I had an academic voice and a journalistic voice. And I immediately figured out that I couldn't use those in a blog. It just wouldn't sound right. So I had to invent a third voice. And the wonderful thing about blogging was you could write about what you were hot about that day. If the New York Times had published a sentence that pissed me off, I could write about what was involved in that sentence. By the way, that would mean a blog post about every day, as a matter of fact. Or people would write in comments to me and say, an editor would say, I'm having trouble with my writers who are doing so-and-so. Can you write a post about that? And I'd write a post about it. And it was the most exciting writing I've ever done because I was always writing about what I was hot about. And so the book got written essentially that way, but now you're going to turn it from a blog into a book. It wasn't written in order. It was written in order of heat. So what I had to do was rearrange the whole book so it made sense. And essentially I organized it around the writing process, plus the last section is about voice. And so it was a sorting out process, which by the way I did with Post-it notes. I put each post on a Post-it note and then rearranged them all a big whiteboard to make it all come out right.
Did you have to change the format or the structure of the article or the post that you'd written to get it into the book format?
Yes, I did, and the main problem was repetition. Remember that every blog post has to stand by itself, and so they were constantly repeating definitions and stuff like that, and that would have really wrecked the flow. And so I took most of the repetition out, and I have an agent, and my agent said, is this book for journalists or is this book for general writers? And I said, it's for general professional writers who want to write better. And she said, all right, take all the journalistic examples out. And that was half of them, half of them from newspapers. So I stripped all those out and put in a whole new set of examples, mostly from coaching and from reading. And that worked a lot better, as a matter of fact. I didn't have to explain terminology and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
So did you have like a really specific set of writers you wrote this for? Is this just for a narrow segment of writers?
No. It's for a very broad segment of writers. It's not for beginners. It does not teach you to write. It teaches you to write better. The assumption is that you are a writer, usually a professional writer, and that you have some experience, but you want to write better. And by the way, I find all experienced writers want to write better. They just don't know how. So this is, if you think about it, the purpose of this book is to free people up to write the way that they really should in the first place.
It feels like, and you actually state in one place, that the book is planned for nonfiction writers who are not journalists. I don't write fiction, but it seems to me that there are pieces within the book that would be as useful for a fiction writer, that there could be people in this audience who write fiction who would get as much out of this book as those of us who don't.
Yes, well, I'll tell you why that happened. It's because the things that I teach about writing were drawn from other genres and other media. They were drawn from fiction, they were drawn from movies, they were drawn from radio, and they were drawn very much from speech making, from rhetoric. And so, essentially, I've stolen from other fields and then said to people in those fields, oh, by the way, this book will help you, you see, even though it's not written for you. That's what it amounts to. But for instance, the discussion of character in there is directly out of fiction writing. So.
One of the conversations we had earlier was, and it's something you devote a total section in your book to, is the idea of voice. And the voice of a professor is very different from a journalist and extremely different from a blogger. So talk to us a little bit about voice, and then I have another question.
Okay. Take a look at your handout, please. If you don't have one, get where you can look on. Okay? Everybody got one? Second item. This is a definition of voice. Voice is a collection of devices used consistently to create the illusion of a person speaking through the text. Writers create their voices by repeating the same devices over and over, such as sentence complexity and length, level of language, sophistication of reference, etc. In the 7th century B.C., somebody made a little pot, which is about the size of your fist. And up on the shoulder of the little pot, in the earliest inscription in Greek, it says, whoever dances best wins me. Whoever dances best wins me. The little pot is a prize in a dancing contest. The pot speaks. Whoever dances best wins me. The text speaks. And that's the basic metaphor of our profession. As I read this, the author speaks through the text. Voice is that illusion that somebody is speaking to through a text. Can I show them how we analyze voice?
You may do that. I think you might.
Okay, so let's look at the next item. This is a passage from my friend Roy Peter Clark's writing tool, but an excellent book. I'll read it to you in a moment. We'll talk about how the voice works. Americans do not write for many reasons. One big reason is the writer's struggle. Too many writers talk and act as if writing were slow torture, a form of procreation without arousal and romance, all dilation and contraction, grunting and pushing. As New York sports writer Red Smith once observed, writing is easy. All you do is sit down at the typewriter and open a vein. The agony in Madison Square Garden. Now, this is a very typical passage for Roy, and it's a very distinctive voice that you can hear. What makes that voice that voice? First of all, it's very informed. It has normal language and a little bit of scientific terminology like procreation, words like that, dilation and contraction, sitting next to grunting and pushing. He uses the verb to be a lot to sound conversational. He varies his sentence length. And everything Roy writes is going to have a reference to sports and religion within 1 inch, everywhere through it. And so that's why you get the agony in Madison Square Garden. And so this is typical of Roy. Now, if I wrote this, it wouldn't sound like this at all. And that's what voice is. It's sounding like yourself, essentially. Okay?
So the second piece of that question is, do we come to writing with our own voice? Do we pick it up because we read nothing but William Faulkner? Or how do we get to our voice? And can we change it?
Yes, you can. There are essentially three ways to create a voice or to create a new voice. And you'd have more than one, of course. The first way is simply to write. If you write over a long period of time, you will fall into certain habits, and those are the habits that will be your voice. All writing has voice. Even the flattest writing has voice. Flat writing is a voice itself. That's the first way. The second way is to imitate other writers. You pick writers who are doing things that you admire, and you try to sound like them. And you don't try to hit them exactly, you try to parody. You got to overshoot. My son taught himself to write like that. When he was 11 years old, he decided to be a novelist. And so he decided to parody a different writer each year and develop his voice that way. 11-year-olds can think like that, believe me. And so the first year, he parodied Conan the Barbarian. My wife and I had a hard time that year. The following year, he parodied Isaac Asimov. Okay? And each year he parodied a different one, and by the time he was 18 he had a voice. So what you do is you imitate things you like and try to put them together, but you have to practice over a while to make that work. The third way to do it is do it by devices. This is what I'm talking about here. And that is, you figure out what you would like to sound like, and you figure out what voice, what devices would give you that sound. And then you use those devices. You keep experimenting until you've got a voice. For instance, when I was a beginning assistant professor here in 1966, I decided to develop a writing voice as a professor. What I wanted to do was sound as authoritative as possible and as clear as possible. So I took Strunk and White. Everybody's read Elements of Style. I took Strunk and White and took everything that they said and did it absolutely. The problem was I ended up sounding like Strunk, not White. But that was what I wanted. You see, I wanted an absolutely clear, authoritative voice. The greatest compliment I ever got on my writing was somebody said, you could cut yourself on Don's prose. You see, I don't think that was a compliment, as a matter of fact. When I decided to go into journalism, teaching journalism, that voice was too stiff, so I had to develop a new one. In my previous voice, I never used the verb to be at all. Everything was strong verbs. There was no passing anywhere in it. I relaxed that to sound more conversational by introducing the verb to be. And then when I developed the third voice, the blog, I used probably the verb to be probably 75% of the sentences, because that's the same percentage of the verb to be in American conversation when you're talking to each other. So essentially, that's a way of putting it together by devices. Okay?
Okay. Mm-hmm. I love the dash. I just love the dash. I just love it. And you did a blog post for Writer House. Mm-hmm. I think you took on the dash.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, I'm looking at this and going, oh, great. I'm going to interview this man. I love the dash. I admit that I probably use the dash because I don't know what else to put in there. And in your book, you have that wonderfully illustrated section where you have like six other options that might use. But I love you call it an ambiguous road sign.
Mm-hmm.
So just, you obviously have a thing about the dash, so just talk to us about it.
Okay. I have to do this standing up because I don't have a whiteboard. I think of sentences as journeys. They're roads. And the punctuation is the roads, is the signs on the road. And let's think about what road signs are for. They tell you what to do and what's going to happen next. They give you a command, and they're predictive as well. And that's what punctuation does. And if you're a clarity freak like me, this book is about how to write clearly. If you're a clarity freak like me, you want unambiguous signs. You want the reader to know exactly what to do. Okay, so you're rolling along in a sentence, and you come to a period. What does that mean? Stop. And what comes next? Another sentence, not necessarily related. Right? You're rolling along in a sentence, you come to a semicolon. What does that mean? What's next?
Related.
Okay. Stop. Related sentence coming. Related clause, essentially. Okay. You're rolling along in a sentence, you come to a open quotation mark. What does that mean? And what happens next?
Dialogue.
The quote has started. And what will happen next?
You'll hear it.
Okay. You're rolling along in a sentence, and you come to an open parentheses mark. What does that mean? What's going to happen next?
Something extra.
Something inserted, and there will be a closed quotation, a closed parent, right? You will close the thing. You're rolling along a sentence, and you come to a dash. What does that mean, and what's going to happen next?
Another way of saying
it.
Another way of saying it.
I can't do.
Another way of saying it.
Maybe. You don't know, do you?
No, you don't.
No, you don't. In many cases, it means I can't think of any other punctuation mark that would like you. So, if you really want absolute lack of ambiguity, you would never use the dash, and I never do. And at the top of every manuscript that I submit, I type, do not edit dashes into this copy. In this book, the copy editor put in one, and they had a very stern talk. But it's okay, you can use
duly
it.
Duly noted, thank you.
Why not using this part of my voice? There's a device I'm leaning up.
Well, I think every writer would like at some point, this is my fantasy, to become so well known for what they do that they say like maybe, is it Dave Eggers who writes those long, long, long tomes? So they kind of go, oh, it's his style, it's his thing, mm-hmm. and he gets a pass because he's famous and his book is this big. Mm-hmm. So,
well, look at Faulkner, for instance. Faulkner's famous for sentences that are sometimes pages long, but they're clear. That's the amazing thing about those sentences. They're clear. And he is using devices in such a way that essentially by stringing things out to the right, he gives you the subject and verb and then everything is out to the right, nothing put inside anything else. And you can have a two-page sentence that's clear. Mm-hmm. There's a voice for it.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about clarity, mm-hmm. brevity. You made a comment a little while ago that I wrote down. You said the plunger writes long and cut, and then cuts back.
Mm-hmm.
So in order, one of the devices that you use in the book to explain sort of how to, I like the word brevity, so and you used that someplace. So in order to explain that, you used a Twitter example. You used an example where you had to find 140 mm-hmm. characters to say something. And what I loved about the way you did it is that you probably used at least four different examples mm-hmm. of how to pull that together
mm-hmm.
and not lose the meaning and actually make it tighter and sharper. So I think that that's something we all struggle with, is how mm-hmm. how do we clean it up without losing something? So mm-hmm. could you talk a little bit about how mm-hmm. how we do that?
Well, let's talk about how not to do it. Most people trying to write in 140 characters and spaces mash things, you see, and they use all these crazy codes and stuff like that, and use a lot of alphabets as words and so forth. And that's a form of compression. The secret of writing briefly and short is selection. It's throwing things out, not mashing things in. And so, actually, there were 10 examples in that.
Ten.
And I started out with 148 characters and spaces. And instead of just taking out 8, I reconsidered what I was saying. and I took out the whole concept. Now it's down about 130. So I revised the concept, something else I wanted in there. What I was talking about was what's called the internal critic. Every writer has this voice in your head that looks out through your eyes. There's a little, I don't know if you know this, but there's a little chair right behind your eyes, and the internal critic sits behind there and looks out at what you're putting on the screen. And so you type a sentence and he says, "That sentence sucks." And there's a little pause and he says, "By the way, the one before it is even worse." And if you let him keep talking, he says, "By the way, the next one you haven't typed yet is going to be much worse than that." And if you let him keep talking, he's going to say, "You're a phony. Nobody will read you. Your mother was right about selling insurance." And my internal critic says to me, "Run out of the room. They'll laugh at you if you print this." Okay, that's how mean mine is. So this is what it was about. And the question was, I was writing about the internal critic in 140 characters and spaces. And I had to get the voice in there, and so I kept throwing things out until I ended up with my focus on the monster and how to deal with the monster. Okay?
Great. I have a feeling that there are going to be a lot of questions, so I'm going to ask you one more question.
Okay.
And then I'll let you ask a question that you want answered, and then we'll turn it over. So sort of to wrap this up, if each of us could only, if we could only take away one piece of advice, if there was just one thing you wanted us to get out of that book, one thing we could change, one piece of advice, what would it be? I mean, what would you like to say to us if you only had one thing?
Everybody has what I call little dinosaurs in their process. It's something you do that hurts you, and you keep doing it because you don't know any other way. And my advice would be to figure out what that dinosaur is and get rid of it. And it's almost impossible for you to find it. You've got to sit down with somebody else who will ask you questions about how you do your writing process. One question that gets you there is any part of your process slow? Wherever you feel it takes too much time, that's probably where the problem is, you see. And so I think if you really want to write better and faster and reduce the agony, you would find the dinosaur and find another way to do that. It ain't easy to do, but it really makes a huge difference. It really does. Okay?
Okay. Is there a question you wish I had asked you that you want to answer?
No, that was it. No, I want to hear what they want to say.
Okay. So we'll take some questions.
To do this. Another is to sit down with somebody smart who's also a writer. Or just sit down with somebody smart and have them ask you the right questions. Often when I ask a writer, can you give me a list of your strengths as a writer and what are your weaknesses? They will say, "I don't have any strengths," and they'll immediately start listing weaknesses. The reason is that writers are very critical people, particularly themselves. This is why we keep tearing ourselves apart. So you need somebody to keep you on the subject. And you want to ask the question right. What are your strengths as a writer, you see? And the strengths might be, I'm terrific at gathering information. I'm terrific at evaluating. I'm great at coming up with ideas. I write extremely fast because I know exactly what I want to say, you see? And then you want to know what the weaknesses are. And you can get at that by asking something like, what kind of things give you trouble as you're writing? Or what kind of things make you slow? What makes you afraid? Have you ever had a writer's block? What's making that happen? And so on. And that gives you essentially a list, you see. Now, what you want to do is you want to strengthen the strengths. And what you want to do is change or work around the weaknesses. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
and works best with you. Can't almost cannot do this without another person.
Perhaps a writer's group, a writing group?
Yes. If it's, well, can I be mean about writer's groups?
Please do.
I come from the world of newspapers, and where there are critiques and writer's groups, and I try to get them to stop critiquing, because the tradition is so savage. All they do is chew each other up. And if you have a writer's group where all you do is criticize each other, you're damaging each other, frankly. I think most writer's groups' discussions should be very positive, and they should be about technique and that kind of thing. So you want to have the right group to ask you those questions, particularly when you start going into what are your problems. So you don't want people to say, if you weren't so stupid, you wouldn't do that. Well, sometimes that's true.
Okay. Yeah. How do you find someone who is capable of, critiquing your work? I mean, every writer I know of who's published at least one book has someone who does critique their work for them. And, they look to that person to maybe critique the next piece that they're doing. I don't know anybody in the writer's circle I'm moving mm-hmm. who has that. Mm-hmm. And I certainly need it. I've just finished one book. I had one I finished in 9 months, and it was fiction. And this one is fiction, but based mm-hmm. on a very true story. And now I'm trying to move into some articles around this, but I have no one to look to. Mm-hmm. And I know all kinds of people have the same problem I'm facing.
Mm-hmm. I think the easy answer is you can find yourself a writing coach. And I'll talk about that later. The truth is, the reader you need is not a writer. You see, we don't write for writers, we write for readers.
Right.
What you really need is somebody smart, who is a good reader, and reads well.
And reads in your genre.
And reads in your genre, exactly. If you write mysteries, you need somebody who reads mysteries.
Right.
But I find that civilians do this better than writers.
Okay.
So you need somebody smart who read like a reader. Talk like a reader. That's right.
Well, I don't know if this will work for you, but what I did was I went to a friend who lives in a different city, and I asked her to ask her book club if anyone was willing to read an excerpt for me and comment on me on it because they wouldn't know me. Mm-hmm. And I got some really great critiques, and one of the women turned out to be a former editor.
Mm-hmm.
And, they didn't know me, so they weren't mm-hmm. shy about it, but they also weren't cool.
Mm-hmm.
And they're women who read a lot.
That's a great idea.
I don't know.
That's a terrific idea. And also, you can ask the reader to mark only certain things. For instance, I used to have this brilliant secretary when I was in the Poynter Institute who knew absolutely nothing about anything that I ever wrote about. And so I gave her every draft I wrote. And I said, read this and put a check in the margin beside anything you don't understand. You see, that was the perfect general reader. You couldn't get better than that. I never asked her, do you like it? Whereas I didn't say, is it good or bad? I said, just check, put a check aside what you don't understand. Others? Yes?
I have kind of a, I don't know if it's a common issue with writing, but I like to craft sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself in my first draft just crafting the hell out of everything and finding hard to keep going. What if,
yes. First of all, draft and revise. Most people draft and revise at the same time. They type a sentence, and the sentence is not perfect, so they fix it. And then it's still not quite perfect, so they fix it again. And then they type the second sentence, which makes the first sentence wrong, so they fix the first sentence. And then they fix the second sentence, which is now wrong, but now the first sentence got wrong again. And then they fix the title of the piece and go back and write the third sentence. And if you do that, it not only takes a long time, it damages your confidence. But sooner or later, you're going to say, why is this so hard? This is why we talk about agony. See? And the way to get around that is to draft without revising. Draft without revising. Don't revise anything. That's easy to say and hard to do. For instance, I do it that way because I type so bad. If I fixed errors as I put them up on the screen, I would never get any sense then. So I leave them alone. but you have to be willing to leave a misspelled name on the screen. Okay? That's the extreme form. And most people will do some lighter version of that. They'll draft, do a little correcting, just the stuff they can't stand, and then they revise the whole thing. So the fast way really is no revision at all, and then revise it once. So, one thing I always do that helps a lot is as soon as I finish drafting and take a break, I print out a copy and I read the piece aloud with a pencil in my hand. And by aloud I mean words come out of my mouth and go into my ears. So that you hear everything. When you read silently, you don't read the words, you read phrases, you see. And then I put a check in the margin beside anything I want to change. I don't stop and fix it. I want to get the flow. And then I've got a whole list of, in the margin of exactly what I want to go back and change. Now some of you are looking at me like I'm stark raving mad. So I'm going to be a little starker raving than mad. If you would like to try drafting without revision at all, this is something you do once in your whole life. This is not a way to compose. It's something you do just once to show yourself you can draft without revising. Now, first of all, you're writing something that's not important. It doesn't count. And you write down the time, and you turn the screen off. Some computers you can do that, some you hang a towel. The point is you can't see the screen. And then you type as fast as you possibly can, watching your fingers. You don't want to get off, you see. You just blast away until you think you've hit the bottom. Then you stop, record the time, take the towel off the screen. Now here's the problem. What's on that screen is better than anything you normally write, and it's sometimes better than anything you've written your whole life. And you've just ripped it in half the time. And it's damn near finished. How can that be? But your internal critic can't see. You can't sit there and say, that sentence sucks. You can't say, who write that? I would not use that as a composition method, but it's a good way to see it. Okay? Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Who else? Yes.
About that dash. I've been in writing classes and it seems to be an issue. Is there an occasion in dialogue that it could be appropriate?
I think it's all.
As far as like, if that's sort of something's about to happen.
Yeah. It's always appropriate. It's one more tool in the toolbox that you use. I don't use it because I'm a clarity freak. I do not want my reader at any point not knowing where we're going. You see, so I just cut it out. Most writers are not as extreme as I am about things like this. I would say that if you use a lot of them, it creates an impression of not knowing what you're talking about. It creates an impression of indecision, essentially. So if you're going to use them, use them well. Now, having said that, to pick up what you just said, there's one place that I really wish we had some sort of punctuation mark, but we don't. And that is, I like to quote people, and I like to tell how they spoke. And I like to put the pauses in. And the only thing I can think of to do that is a dash. If you put in three dots, as I did in my novel, unfortunately, it looks like ellipses. And the reader will wonder, what did you mean about? Mm-hmm. So that's when I would be tempted to use a dash. But you can use a dash, you know. It's part of your voice. Okay? Yes, sir.
How do you feel about exclamation points?
Exclamation points? Nine-year-old girls like them. I think they should be pretty rare, in fact, because they're... If you use a lot of them, the reader notices them. And suddenly the reader's paying attention to what you're doing, not what you're saying. And I think it's better to write strong verbs and strong nouns and so forth, so you don't need the exclamation. I think in the novel I just wrote, the novel's about 250 pages long, but probably three or four. And all four of them are spoken by a sheriff. Okay. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't use them. It's just another tool you've got. Okay. Others?
Have we won that?
Well, Will,
yes.
go ahead.
Do you use a particular software to write? Word, Scrivener.
Mm-hmm. I use Word because I like it. I used to use Xywrite because it was so controllable. And I use Word because it's easy to integrate pictures. I taught myself how to use Photoshop and also how to draw on the computer, so I can put pictures in. I can draw maps, charts, and stuff like that. And that's all very easy to do in Word. So I use Word for that. For my blog, I use WordPress. WordPress is free and it's absolutely transparent in the way it works. You don't have to go on the net to figure out how to use it. It just tells you essentially how to use it. And you can get a blog up and running in about 20 minutes using WordPress. All right, I do want to ask you a question. I've been talking about writing coaching, and I want to tell you why I joined Writer's House. I did this spring. I've been sitting in my kitchen writing books, and I suddenly realized I didn't have anybody to talk to. because I'm a newspaper writing coach, consultant, and so forth, and the newspapers don't have any money to train, and so I'm not getting invited to talk to them anymore. So I decided, well, I need some writers to talk to. So I joined Writer's House, and here's what I want to ask you. I'm thinking of starting up coaching sessions, which people would sit down with me for about 15 to 20 minutes and talk about a problem. The format would be, what do you do? What do you want to help with? About 15 minutes worth. It could be done in groups of four. It could be done individually. And there'd be no charge for this. Just simply scheduling it after you come in here.
Well, I'll volunteer right away.
What I would not do, what I don't do in coaching is I don't deal with text. I don't read your text and tell you whether you're any good. What I do is I go into your writing process. The problems in writing are not in the text, they're in the process that produces the text. So writing coaches work in the text. You still interested?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
But that means you have to be very self-aware of your own process, correct? I don't even know whether I am aware.
So, up to a few minutes
ago,
you would.
I'd have to disagree with not being aware of your process. I find when I'm having the most trouble writing is when my ideas aren't clear, or if there's some emotional involvement. And so when I'm struggling, that's a signal for me to step away. Or show my writing to someone else rather than to beat myself in my head. And having written one book, it really became clear to me that was really essential, is to be constantly checking in with my gut as to whether I'm struggling or not, even though writing about fiction. So for me, that was probably one of the most important discoveries. Writing.
Well, it usually takes people a while to discover that when it's not working, stop doing it. Just stop. For instance, I have periods of about 3 weeks at a time that I call the blacks. And I can't think straight at all, much less what. So I don't. I just don't write in the blacks, essentially. I hope you don't have 3 week blacks. But when it's not working, just stop and talk to somebody else or walk around the block. Newspaper people drink. That doesn't help.
Isn't there a period of time when you write something and you want to critique it yourself? I've always been told that there's a period of time you should wait before you go back and try to critique.
Did you all hear her question back there?
Isn't there a period of time when you should wait before you revise it? But yes, there is. And it depends. A lot of things. Sometimes it's 10 minutes, and sometimes it's 10 years. And essentially, what you need is a break to get away from it. If you think you've finished the draft, then take the break. And that's when I advise coming back and reading aloud, because you'll see everything you need to do. The problem is that you can get so immersed in it, you just simply can't see it anymore. When I was writing this novel that I wrote, I suddenly discovered chapters I'd forgotten, you see, because I didn't get far enough away from it before I came back to revise it. So that's absolutely necessary, kind of thing. Yes? Yeah?
My problem is my internal critic has a huge mouth. He won't shut up. I can never... when do you know... when is enough revisions enough? When do you know? I mean, because I'll revise something 10 times. It'll never get done because it's like... And you can get hung up on one word, you know, using thrust instead of juts or whatever. You know, it's... that's my issue. Is I get so excited when I have an idea, a story pop in my head. I get so excited about it, and then I wear myself down getting caught up in revisions. So.
The best writer at the Grace Ware Daily News could never finish anything. She just simply kept revising. And her editor finally devised a way to get it to stop. And that is, he would walk up behind her in the newsroom at 3 a.m. and he'd lean on her shoulder and say, "Greta, hit the save key." He'd be able to hit the save key. I think you want to revise until the piece is ready to go to the next step. You're very rarely at the end of the process. You say, well, it's good enough for the next part of the team, which is probably editors, to start working on it. And you want them to have something to do. Yes?
I want to go back to what your question was. I'd be interested.
I do this in two formats. One is one-on-one. Some people want to be very private. The other kind I do is one-on-four. And you have 4 people in the room, everybody gets 15 minutes. You see. And one-on-fours work better because the other 3 discover that they have the same problem. And it almost always results in a new team. Those 4 people will go away. So the other kind of coaching is for deep problems, and that usually takes about an hour. Somebody who's just been in writer's block for 2 years or something. That's pretty rare.
So would it be fair, I mean, you've talked about doing this, and he's talked with some of us on the board about setting this up, so we'll sort of work on that to see if we do it. Are you also willing to, or do you take on... clients for pay who want a more intensive thing? I mean, you're offering to do this as a sort of a donation to Writer House.
Right.
Do you also take private clients?
Generally, I do not. Usually, I work only with organizations. I prefer that. Okay. But occasionally, I do take on private clients. And it's usually because they're doing something I really want to work. I met the wife of a friend of mine at a party in Washington, D.C. I'll stand up so you can hear. I met the wife of a friend of mine in Washington, D.C., and she had been writing a novel for 6 years, meaning revising it for 6 years. So she just simply couldn't get it out. Her husband, who was a professional writing coach, had rewritten it 10 times. And they both got to the point where they were speaking.
No, my goodness.
And I said, "Let me have it, I'll edit it." And so I took it and I edited it and essentially made it work. The problem was it was slow. And I speeded it up most by taking things out. You see, it came out. You see, the marriage was saved.
All right, on that note, then I think we'll stop so that we have time for you all to talk to him one on one if you'd like. We do have the books here for sale, and Don will sign them for you as well. I mean, we could go on forever, but I know you all want to roll on, and he's here, and I think he'd be happy to talk to you for a little bit.
Sure. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much.